really am very excited. We're talking to Krista Tippett. I probably don't have to tell WNPR listeners who that is. She's a journalist and host of On Being. She's the author most recently of Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Also the author of Einstein's God, Conversations about Science and the Human Spirit. She's won all kinds of awards. I'll be here all day if I start identifying her that way. So we want to instead plunge into the book. But Krista Tippett, first of all, welcome to this show.
I am glad to be with you.
And before we plunge into the book itself, which I promise you we will do at great length, can we talk a little bit about you? First of all, how comfortable are you talking about you? Often people who interview for a living don't necessarily like talking about themselves.
Right. Well, I had to completely shift gears in order to write the book. Talking about the book now that it's written is not so hard, but we're talking about those ideas. But as you understand, which is, you know, the intelligence behind the question is that when I'm interviewing people, I'm not talking about myself, even if I'm present. So that's why writing it was so hard, because I realized I had to put myself into the ideas. You know, that's what I try to do in my interviews, and I know what makes it listenable is when you draw people out, not just about what they think, but who they are, right? And not just the ideas, but the lives we lead. But it was very daunting and not that comfortable to put myself through those paces as well.
All right. Well, I will try to make you as uncomfortable as possible as we go along here. I want to also just begin with what your mission has been. My experience with public radio, and I've only been here since 2009, is that the institution and its audience can be a little uncomfortable with topics like faith and spirit and soul. There's an unusually high percentage of people who think of themselves as rationalists and think of faith or soul as superstitions. Did you feel, especially in the early years as you established yourself doing this, did you feel kind of like an odd duck?
I absolutely felt like an odd duck, and it was actually a big struggle, and it was something I had to fight for years. There was a lot of skepticism in newsrooms about whether this could be something, a subject that you could talk about on public radio with public radio values of intelligence and balance, and something that wouldn't be inflammatory or make people angry, make people feel excluded, proselytizing. I mean, I have to say, I did understand that skepticism because we don't have a lot of great models in public life in general, or even in journalism, about coming at this subject in a way that, let's say, opens imaginations up rather than shutting them down. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a struggle.
Yeah, no, you got you and you got Bill Moyers, and it starts to thin out a little bit after that. So I did a job a little bit like yours about 35 years ago, but it was at a newspaper. And after a while, I felt like I was circling around the buffet table of faith, spirit, religion, commitment kind of endlessly. And I felt more disoriented than nourished by that process.
Really?
And I guess I'm asking you that question. You've been a conduit, for 40, 50 different points of view per year. And maybe does that make it hard for you to stabilize your own sense of spirituality?
It's an interesting way you're stating the question. I mean, sometimes people assume that I must be the most enlightened person on the planet.
I was going to come to that.
because I have all these conversations and I get to say, there's a wise person. I'm going to engage in, I'm going to go deeply in conversation with them and immerse myself in their work. The truth is, I'm very fortunate to do the work I do, but I also, like everyone else, just have a real messy life outside the studio, and I imperfectly apply all the enlightened teachings that I receive. Just like everyone else, I am nourished by the conversations and I suppose, what's happened with this project is that I feel like we've been listening to the culture in these years as much as we've been listening to our guests and our listeners. And this part of life, which, that we call religious or spiritual, moral imagination is a phrase I like. This is a rapidly evolving part of American culture and I think, human life in the 21st century. And I think by following that and taking this on as an adventure, it's, you know, it's been endlessly surprising and really refreshing. So I don't know, I guess that, and I feel that in, I feel that also in how I continue to imperfectly internalize what I learned into my life.
Well, we'll come back to the whole question of you as the ultimate bodhisattva later on in this conversation. But you know what you do say in the book, by the way, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living, you do say, Krista Tippett, in the book, that one question you don't ask in interviews is something along the lines of, and I may be misparaphrasing it, what's the current state of your spiritual life, or what's your relationship with God? Why not ask that question?
Because that is a question that words will, it's as intimate as any other question I could ask you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you religious? What do you believe? How's your spiritual life right now? It's also something that ultimately is always going to defy words. So I one of the things I have pursued, one of the convictions I've pursued in these years is that we must find ways to talk about this important part of ourselves in public. But the language we use and the approach we have to that has to be so intelligent and sensitive to how sensitive the material is. And so to ask that kind of straight on linear question, I think would render almost all of us, including me, kind of not very inarticulate, and you would freeze up if someone asked you that question.
It is true. I was asked a version of that question within the last 3 or 4 days, and I did freeze up. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
By my pastor, actually. Anyway, you, who I suppose has a right to ask that question. But anyway, do you? I want to come back to this question about you as a bodhisattva, because I do think maybe your listeners or even somebody picking up this book is thinking that maybe you do have some kind of Promethean secret that you've talked to everybody, you know, that you're like the Nate Silver of religion. You know, you looked at all of the numbers here. You can average them all out. And you see, somehow or other, you know, you have a distillation maybe at the end of that process. So based on what you just said earlier in this conversation, that's not how you feel.
It's not how I feel as a human being. But I wrote the book because I have learned some things, right? And I want to share what I've learned. But the creative tension in the book, or the creative premise of the book, that I got clearer and clearer on in as I was pulling together, you know, because the question, kind of the orienting question for the book was, well, you know, what have I learned? What are the recurring qualities and the recurring themes in Lives of Wisdom? And part of that has been so important to me even personally is to really demystify, you know, saintliness or mm-hmm. even wisdom, that this is not something that's up on a pedestal, that even the most saintly, wise people we could think of in history, in fact, were three-dimensional creatures just like us. But that what I've learned from these graceful lives is that we have precisely the raw materials that we've been given in our stories and in our everyday, to aspire to be to be our best selves as a practice, and to be kind of spiritually evolving. And so, yeah. So, I mean, I practice that too.
Reading the book, I got the feeling that probably there are a lot of occasions, and I'm going to invite you maybe to describe or mention one of them, where you walk away from the interview in this pretty ecstatic state, thinking, "Oh, that was it. You know, I just got handed the key." And that gradually you, instead of that being the case, you kind of fit it into the mosaic of everything that you've heard and learned and incorporated into your own way of living. But do you want to mention one time where at least in the immediate afterglow you thought, "Oh, no, that's it. That's the whole thing. He or she just told me everything I need to know about the mystery of life."
Well, you're right that I often have at least one real gift, you know, coming out of an interview. I would say, you know, recently I interviewed this physicist named Frank Wilczek, and he's a Nobel physicist, and I interview many scientists. I mean, this is one of the kind of paths I walk down.
Right. There are more poets and scientists in this book than there are theologians.
That's it. That's it. Poets and scientists. And that's something, if you'd told me 12 years ago that I'd be interviewing a lot of physicists, I would have been very surprised, and possibly about the poets as well. And what's interesting about him is that he – so I think that people on scientific frontiers, you know, physics, neuroscience – they may or may not be religious themselves. They may or may not be at all interested in theological questions. But, you know, in these spheres, we are actually – people are actually posing questions that are that were the kinds of things that philosophers and theologians did before, and making discoveries and having insights that, in fact, are spiritually, theologically evocative. But what's interesting about Frank Wilczek is he's actually willing to go there. He's interesting to say, yeah, I learned this. And he's not religious, but I learned this from physics, and this has relevance to life. So one of the things he told me that kind of fits your bill that I haven't been able to stop thinking about is, you know, he said he talked about what deep truth – you know, and this is as a physicist. And he said one of the one example of this is the great debate that Einstein had that he kind of helped solve. You know, is light a particle or a wave? And the answer is that it's both, but it depends on what question you're asking, and you can't actually come up with both answers at the same time. And he said that the definition of a deep truth is that it's a deep truth, right, is that its opposite is also true.
Right.
Although you can't entertain those two truths at the same time. And what I want to – so I've thought about that so much. And I also just will share that I spoke about that at a book event we had here in Minneapolis. The mayor of Minneapolis was there. She just gave her State of the City address last week. And she wove it around this notion of the deep truth from the physicist, from, you know, from this program about the human condition. And I think what she talked about is true of, you know, all of our cities, right? It's this, you know, we have all these huge heartbreaking challenges, and that is a deep truth. And another deep truth is all the incredible initiative and promise and goodness and, you know, this abundant energy that's out there to help heal and help create new resilient structures. So that would be a recent example that I'm really living with.
Right. And I'm with you on the physics stuff. I mean, actually, one of the things that keeps popping up in this book is the way that the truths or the ideas, they don't change that much in some ways. That Brian Greene in your book sounds a lot to me like William James explaining radical empiricism. Mm. And that the string theory stuff in your book sounds a lot like Plato, right? The notion of a hologram projected from some primal source. These ideas that people have been exploring for millennia, they're reworded and rephrased and enlarged upon and enriched and deepened. But, you know, in some ways, we're asking a lot of the same questions as Plato.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's why – but what I love – you know, we have all these new rich images and these new rich discoveries and vocabulary because these are such huge truths. And I think we need all those vocabularies and all those images to start to, you know, create an accumulative imagination that can approximate them.
Now, the book is divided up into five themes, and we're going to try to touch on all of them as time permits. But as we head towards our first break, maybe we can talk a little bit about the first section, which is called Word and Words. And it's also about stories. You have a lot of people talking about the notion of story. One of them says that sometimes we need stories more than we need food almost. And you do share some of your own stories, including one about your father, who had literally a nightmarish childhood, the kind of childhood that produced nightmares in him. Can you tell a little bit of that story now and explain how it fits into what you're trying to say in that section?
Yes. So one of the kind of breakthroughs of this writing was realizing that I've never really talked about that part of my story. But as I was pondering what it is I've learned about how our words become powerful and how we touch each other with our stories, you know, and how when I talk to people, as I always do at the beginning of my conversations, about the spiritual background of their childhood, I mean, I do that because everybody has a story, but I do it more because it's that part of our lives is a place that is searching and it's full of questions. And I find, interestingly, that that a lot of the questions people end up following for the rest of their lives somehow in their professions or in their avocation, there's roots of that in your early life. And I realized very late in the writing of this that I'd never kind of really critically posed that question to myself. I'd posed the question of the religious background of my childhood, but the spiritual background of your childhood is more expansive than that. And I realized that, you know, one of the very sad and puzzling features of my childhood was the fact that there were things in my house that we could not speak about and questions we could not ask. And primary among that was, you know, my father had been, I knew that he'd been adopted when he was three, and that he had a little brother and an older sister, and that he knew what his name was, and that at some point his mother had tried to kidnap him back, and that he had screaming nightmares in the middle of the night. But we weren't, I mean, so just those facts, you know, they're just stories and you suspect the worst. And I realized that there was something in me in my early life about the unaskable questions and how they form us and how important it would be to name them and live with them that was still animating me. And, you know, this was just a kind of amazing revelation.
I think for your dad and for all of us, one of the problems with naming something like that is, and I'm going to steal this image from somebody else, but that it's a little bit like those acrobats or trapeze artists who go from ring to ring, that in some ways to let go of that ring, the ring that has on it the troubling childhood, the childhood that was so horrible as to give him nightmares, you've got to know where the next ring is. You've got to be reaching out for the next ring. And if he didn't have that, it might have been very hard to let go of by speaking about all of that trauma.
Absolutely. And we know so much now about the brain of a child that we didn't know then. I mean, I know things. I mean, you know, but what is it as a child, what I was very aware of was a terror in my father and a sadness and that nothing could ever make those things better. Right. And sometimes the ways they came out were, you know, he could be scary. But I think even behind that, I sense that terrified, sad child.
We're talking.
And he couldn't get past that.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it is that. Well, that is the journey, right? Can you get past that mm-hmm. formative thing, the thing that cracks the egg at the beginning? We're talking to Krista Tippett about the book Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the meaning, the mystery and art of living. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back.
God is in your strangest pleasure. Some say God is into leather. God is into body piercing, in your nipple, lip, and nose ring. God is in your new tattoo, in your scars and birthmarks too. God is in your brand new nose, in your control top pantyhose. God is in the latest fad, except for bungee jumping, that's dangerous and bad. God is in your cellular phone. God will not leave you alone. God is in the internet, wondering why you're not there yet. God is in Vogue and Spin and Rolling Stone, because God is...
We're back with Krista Tippett. I don't have to tell you who Krista Tippett is, but she is the host of On Being and, more pertinently, the author of Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the mystery and art of living. This is divided up into five different segments. It's word, flesh, I see what you did there, and love, faith, and hope. So we're still on word, though. And I'm not running the clock very well. We're still on word, and time is slipping away. But I think, first of all, you do talk a lot, and not just in this segment, you do talk a lot to poets. I think people approaching this book might be surprised at how important poets are to you. I'm not, actually, but maybe say what it is, what attracts you to them.
Oh, it's become such an important part of what we do. And I will say, you quoted somebody who talked about story being as important to us as food. And I think I've also realized that, you know, poetry is a way with language of, that we absolutely need. And what I experience in myself and others is we don't necessarily know this. I think poetry feels like kind of a luxury, maybe an elite thing in American culture. But when we put it on the air and we, you know, started doing this in the early years, I see that people just soak it up, right? Just soak it up like you know, they were gasping for it and didn't realize it. It's, and in a larger way, it's, you know, one of the, there's a phrase of Elizabeth Alexander, the poet, in the book about, you know, words that shimmer. We crave words that shimmer. And a more basic realization underneath that, that I think is as true right now and at this moment in American life as it's ever been, is we are craving fresh language to approach each other. And we've not just been careless with words in our public life. We've become so destructive with words, and we don't pay attention to how powerful these incredibly powerful tools that we all carry around with us as the ordinary kind of constant thing of the everyday. And somehow, so my conversations with poets, become a way not just of talking about poetry, but of talking about how really transformative language can be, and how I think the world needs really us to name and know and wield the transformative power of language.
I will now inject myself in here a little bit more and say that it's so odd because before starting your book, I mean right before starting your book, I was emailing back and forth with my own sort of pastor and spiritual mentor who has ALS right now, and we're communicating a lot by email. And she was asking me about poetry, why poetry was important to me. And I said something kind of similar, which is I said sometimes poems – I mean this sounds incredibly trite, but that poems are like friends, or that some words from poems, little phrases, you know, stick in my head, and they're things that I'll just kind of mutter to myself, you know, at moments of need, that because they do. You have Marie Howe in your book saying that the poetry is something that can't be said. It expresses a sentiment that's untranslatable. And so, you know, when Richard Wilbur in Love Calls Us to the Things of This World says, you know, let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves, you know, I sort of know what he means and I sort of don't know what he means. But I know what I mean. I know what I mean when I say that to myself.
And David White is a poet I interviewed recently. And he said, I always ask poets, like, what's your definition? And he said, poetry is language against which we have no defense. And so, I mean, that is a way of putting into relief how wonderful that was. You know, the language that the official language that we are dealing in now, we are all schooled in defense, right? And we wield words in a way that makes other people defend themselves. And we are losing out on the nourishing, healing power of words, the tender possibility of words, the way words can cross the chasms between us.
Right.
As I
was reading that section, I was thinking in some ways, in the ways that you're saying right now, words have gotten kind of a bad reputation. I mean, we say just words or empty words or words that obfuscate, right? It's hard to keep your faith in words.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also so questions are a form of words also that have incredible power. And, you know, what I've learned as a and this is one thing that was a great thing about writing the book, was really thinking this through. And, you know, one thing I have learned is that, you know, questions draw forth answers in their likeness, that, you know, that answers mirror the questions that they, you know, that they rise or they fall to meet. So, you know, we deal in kind of combative questions in this culture, and a combative, it's very hard to transcend a combative question with anything but a combative answer. It's hard not to meet a simplistic question with a simplistic answer, but it's very hard to resist a generous question. And that is a power that we all have it in us, you know, every day, every minute, to use words in that way.
You know, when noticing that that was the name of the first section of the book, I also was thinking a little bit about the beginning of John. You know, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And you know, he was in the beginning with God. And obviously, we think we know what John is talking about, but why do you think John expresses it that way? Why choose the word to talk about the story?
The Logos. Well, I mean, you know, it's a very – it's – and I – you know, you're kind of taking me back to my seminary days, which were in Connecticut at Yale Divinity School. I mean, it's not – it's not in a linear way. You know, it's a – that word is a really seminal Greek concept, and it's – it translates as word. It's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that what you're pointing at – I mean, you know, the rabbis will say, you know, words make worlds.
Right.
It's and it's this. It's a similar thing. It's a similar insight, and about something that we treat so carelessly, right? That we just take for granted.
I've been thinking about that passage actually in a Tippett-esque way, in connection with physics and with the philosophy of physics. There's a philosopher, James Ladyman, who says, looking at particle physics, looking at quantum physics, he says, I think in the end, it may be that the world isn't made of anything. And I think about that in terms of word. I mean, I don't think of it as nothingness. I think of it as not muchingness. And what if the world is made of not muchingness? And what if the word, what if even in that passage, what he's really talking about is, to get back to what you said earlier in this conversation, that really what we're doing is pattern recognition. So much of existence involves us as observers, us picking a choice, wave or particle. What is it? What is this that we're inhabiting right now? Maybe that's a little bit what John means by word, is that we're just constantly reading reality.
Right. Or also, just to carry, I like that analogy farther, that, you know, we choose the questions that we ask, and those questions create realities, right? I mean, the kinds of answers and responses and dynamics that come back at us, we help create those by the way we come at them, by the way we draw them forth.
We're talking to Krista Tippett right now. The book is Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Well, we better move on. We can't stay with word all day. We have to
move
on.
Well, you know, you and I both deal professionally in words, so I think we can be forgiven for dwelling on
this. That's right. We did a little bit. But we should move to flesh. And there's a lot to say. Maybe I'll get you to tell another story. You start by kind of exploring kind of the old-fashioned dualism in some ways the world of the flesh is very different from the world of the spirit, and you grew up in an environment where your grandfather, who was a preacher, saw that in very stark terms, that the temptations of the flesh really were a counter-narrative to living anything like a holy life. And that, you know, in a way that I found very interesting, you sort of came back to that and thought, well, you know, I rejected that kind of dualism at one point. Now I sort of see maybe he had a point in certain ways. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, well, right. I mean, for my grandfather, the body was just basically an entry point of danger and temptation. And, you know, anything bodily was a slippery slope to sin. But what I later realized is that as much as that was taken to an extreme, that there was an intelligence about the body and really a reverence for the power of the body behind all of his rules and his fear, you know, in a world in which addiction, which the 12 steps and AA meetings didn't exist, you know, addiction was a fatal illness. So in fact, drinking or, you know, playing cards, these were some of the things my grandfather was against. I mean, obviously sex was top of the list, and all the things that could cause sex, including dancing and wearing swimming bathing suits. So swimming, right? But also in an age before birth control, in an age when pregnancy out of wedlock would ruin lives, and also, you know, women died in childbirth. So I became forgiving of my grandfather's rules, and also understood how they kind of, they heeded the power of the natural world and our bodies in a way that I think we, you know, later went overboard in pretending like we could be dismissive of. We could ignore. You know, we were in control. And that's not true either.
So one of the things that you, like many people of our generation, look for is sort of a way to harmonize those two things. And you've found it in yoga, I practiced yoga very seriously in like three or four classes a week for about 5 or 6 years. I didn't quite have the experience that you seem to be having. Maybe you should first tell us about Matthew Sanford, because you had a very unusual portal to this.
I did, yeah. So Matthew Sanford is probably one of the, you know, if I had to list my favorite people I've ever interviewed, somebody who's really who really changed me, and he's an important voice in the book. And he's a very renowned yoga teacher. He was paralyzed from the waist down when he was 13 in a car accident, and he spent 20 or 30 years, you know, being told that he should forget his legs and build up his hip. He could have bodybuilder arms, And he eventually decided that he might never walk again, but he wanted to be whole and healed. And being healed might not mean being fixed, but his way of kind of inhabiting his entire body was through a practice of yoga. And he also now is a teacher for able-bodied people, but also for people with disabilities, and he does adaptive yoga. And I think what Matthew's able to do because of his disability is actually really inhabit the kind of, you know, that subtle layer of yoga, which is about connecting your body kind of at an energetic level and not just about muscles and nerve endings. And he has made the most remarkable observations, you know, for example, that he's never known somebody to begin to inhabit their bodies and honestly, like in all its grace and all its flaws, without becoming more compassionate towards all of life. He also says, you know, he's on a trajectory. He was kind of rushed through a trajectory that in fact we all are on, right? I mean, we all don't have a catastrophic accidents at a certain stage, but our bodies are, you know, they're moving. There's an arc of decline. And yet this American thing of fighting it and not, I mean, but you know, and I think as I'm aging, I'm on that trajectory. You know, his point is there's always so much that's growing, even at the same time that other things are changing in a way that we might call decay, and that, you know, being whole, and I mean, I would say this is a lesson from all of my life of conversation, you know, being whole and healed is about, in fact, knowing and internalizing also the things that have gone wrong for us, all the things that are our strengths and our weaknesses and our wounds as well as our strengths, as part of our wholeness. I mean, that's how wise people change, and how we, you know, wisdom is something that you recognize. It's embodied, right? Mm-hmm. You when you see a wise person, the wise people, you know, it's not a possession that they have in their head. It's not just the words that come out of their mouth. It's something you palpably experience. So this physicality of spirituality, this physicality of wisdom, it's absolutely basic to me. And again, not something I could ever have known a decade ago.
I thought one of the interesting things about him, too, we just did a show about Wilhelm Reich, about whom there are many good questions to ask. But Reich believed that the body was kind of a recording angel, you know, just writing down everything that happened to you. And for Matthew Sanford, his body remembers things that he doesn't consciously remember about his accident.
Right. And Matthew made that observation a couple decades ago. You know, now I'm interviewing psychiatrists and people who are understanding, people working in trauma now who are understanding, you know, at the physical level as well as the psychological level, how, you know, trauma and joy, how memory does lodge in our bodies as much as it lodges in, you know, these. And in fact, I think you know, 50 years from now, people will look back and even look at the way we talk about body, mind, spirit, emotions, these things as being separate and not, you know, we are now learning in very concrete ways how unbelievably interactive all of this is. And so I think we are gaining the capacity as individuals and as a species to really have a new imagination about human wholeness. And I think that's very exciting.
All right. Time is trickling away. We've only done 2 out of 5 themes from the book Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. We're going to take a break. If you haven't become wise already, just listening to this, I can almost guarantee you that in the final segment, you will become at least a little more wise with Krista Tippett. We'll take a break and we'll come back after this.
God is in Dura's class on a frequent flyer pass. God is in the pilot light. Dancing through the night, God is in the radio, Wolfman Jack told me so. God is in the microwave, unless you try to use something metal, then the microwave is the devil. Also don't microwave a saran wrap because it forms molecular bonds with your...
Today's show was produced by Colin and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Pope Francis. For show pages, articles, and photos, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, baseballs and basketballs. And now, back to Colin.
We're back with Krista Tippett. Her book is called Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. She also, of course, hosts On Being, which you hear on this very radio station. So the last three segments of the book are love, faith, and hope. I don't know if we'll have time for all of them. That sounds kind of like a sad thing to say. We don't really have time for love, faith, and hope. Too bad. So in the chapter about love, even knowing who Krista Tippett is and what she's like, I didn't necessarily expect to read in a chapter about love about Paul Ryan and a nun, about a black trooper and a white supremacist, about a geophysicist and an astronomer who searches for planets capable of sustaining life. Clearly, Krista Tippett, I've been looking for love in all the wrong places, as the song says. But maybe just pick one of those. And I don't know. The Paul Ryan and the nun is kind of an interesting one. She actually is a pretty big character in that segment.
Yeah, she's Sister Simone Campbell, famous as the nuns on the bus. I do write about love as something that we do in private, and I think that what we can know about love and how complex it is, right? How many facets of love there are in our lives if we really stop to think about it, how many different forms love takes, how it is the most complicated thing we do, it is the most flawed thing we do, and it's also the most redeeming thing we do. And so I think we do get to be searching about all the ways we've learned about love in all its forms. I mean, that's part of our knowledge base. But what's important to me, too, is that I think love is the only aspiration big enough and rich enough to kind of meet the challenge that we have to be a human species in this century. We're connected now, but how do we recognize that on the human condition level so that it can really work? So I want us to take love out of its private bubble in our imaginations and really think about what it could be for love to be a public virtue, for it to be something muscular and robust and resilient. And, you know, I think we have plenty of examples of that, of how transformative that aspiration can be in the civil rights movement, for example. You know, I talk to people about love as a private good, but also a public good. And so Sister Simone Campbell is a nun. She's also a lawyer and a lobbyist. And she's been a nun since she was 18, and she has a serious Zen practice. So mm-hmm. That's all to say, she's a thoroughly modern person. And she is kind of applying her virtue of love to this work she does on Capitol Hill as a lobbyist. And she's had this long relationship with Paul Ryan. Actually, when I interviewed her, it was before he became Speaker of the House. He was the head of the Budget Committee, I believe. And actually, the nuns on the bus were out there. Part of what they were doing out on the road was trying to talk about their concern about the least of these and how that should be reflected in our budget. So it was in part a protest against the Ryan budget. But what she models with him is, I think, what we are all longing to see in our public life, which is they absolutely disagree on the issues, but they are in relationship and they, across the years, have changed each other. And it's just so refreshing to hear her tell stories of how, you know, he ended up defending her.
Yeah.
Even though she's so much his political opposite, when she was attacked by another politician. And to see something interactive going on as opposed to merely adversarial. And I think that's so, if I say we have to figure out what love looks like in public, mm-hmm. You know, that is an example that we start exploring at a very pragmatic level.
the exchanges between the two of them, it reminded me a little bit of athletes at the end of their careers. You know, by the end of their careers, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird realized that they had more in common than they had as adversaries, that they had more lived reality, and they'd made their each other more meaningful. Same thing with John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg, you know, that these are, you know, and there's some way in which in that exchange, which I found quite touching, actually, where Paul Ryan said, said no, you can't talk about her like that. She's doing her job here. She's here, you know, you can't talk. I was touched in a way that Paul Ryan has not previously touched me, you know, by the idea that he
We don't hear those stories. Those stories don't make the headlines like, you know, like great clashes make the headlines.
I think also that one of the things we can segue a little bit into faith from here, because one of the things that faith. So I should just preface this by saying I'm 6 years ahead of you on the road of life right now. And for the last year, for the first time in my life, I've seriously gone to church, like every Sunday gone to church. Never did that before in my life. And one of the things that, you know, if you go to church, no matter what you think, no matter what the architecture of your faith is at any given moment, one thing you start learning is that you really do have to think about this all a little bit more expansively and a little bit different, you know. And so this past Sunday, I had been angry at somebody elsewhere in my life. And I had been rehearsing all these very kind of angry sentences, like, if this ever happens again, or if you ever do this again. And I was sitting there in church listening to the guy giving the sermon. And I, like, this voice completed the sentence in my head, if you ever do this again, I will forgive you.
You know? That's good. Right.
And that's a promise. That's a threat. You know, and somehow or other, you can't live alongside faith even without beginning to think, oh, yeah, so I maybe I don't agree with Paul Ryan that much, or maybe he doesn't agree with me that much. But there's so much more going on.
Yeah. And I'm not sure this is heading into faith. It's kind of about love again. But I'm not interested in faith that's about abstractions. I mean, I think this is where the two things come together. And if we're not dealing in abstractions, we're always dealing with complexity, and we're dealing with both ands. And the thing about love, whether in whatever form that might be, even if it's our imagination about divine love, we are in the people closest to us, the people we love the most, people in our intimate circles of family and friends. There are people in those circles who we have so much in common with, and we're so in sync, and there's all this harmony, peace and joy and love in that, you know, bright sense. And there are people who we choose to stay in relationship with where there are lots of points of difference. And yet we make that staying in relationship, that belonging to each other, a priority. And we figure out how to do that. And it, you know, it sometimes means that there are things we just don't talk about. So it's never this. And I think faith is the same thing, right? It's never this simplistic, you know, easy glide. And when we put these things up on some kind of weird pedestal or turn them into abstractions, we actually alienate ourselves from the real rich possibility of these things.
Krista Tippett, we're getting very short on time. So I'm going to just say to people listening out there right now, we'll talk a little bit more about faith. We don't have any time for hope. You want hope, you got to
read the
book.
It's
going to cost you $28, basically, right. Hardcover.
It's cheaper on Amazon, I have to say.
All right. We like to support our independent booksellers.
I know, I do too.
Go pay bust out retail for Krista Tippett's book. But so, you know, there's a story in the faith section that it's like I have to think about it about 20 more times before I decide what it means to me. But there's a story, and I'm sorry I cannot quote the name, but it's I think you describe him as a millennial who goes into a religious community and starts to find faith while talking to a member of the religious community who's in the process of dying and having his faith shaken by the process. Yeah. Maybe you can sketch that out a little bit more. It's like a thing you have to think about a lot after you
That's Nathan Schneider, who is a millennial who, you know, okay, so we are the first generation of humans who have been free to choose our own spiritual identities, really. Like, it's unparalleled. And so he's a person who, 20-something, who was raised by parents, you know, again, this whole new phenomenon in the future history of humanity, who said, well, you know, we don't belong to any tradition, so go out and choose your own. And they introduced him to a lot. And then, of course, what he ends up doing is getting baptized when he's 17 in the Catholic Church. But the story he told was, and so he's really an amazing person who's tracing the new forms spiritual searching and identity are taking in these new generations. There was a line in that he's written two wonderful books, and one was about Occupy Wall Street, and part about this spiritual strain in that you never heard about. And the other is kind of about this. It's like the search for God from the ancients to the internets. And there's a line in his book, which is a line of poetry of William Blake, and I can't remember it myself either, but it's about what you hang on to. I don't know. Anyway, it's about not being able to hang on to something. And he put it in there, and it didn't quite make sense to me. So I asked him, like, what does this line of poetry mean to you? And then there was an incredible story behind it, that it was, he'd gone on retreat at a monastery, which is another thing a lot of people are doing, religious and non-religious. And this monk had become his mentor and part of his kind of his companion in becoming Catholic. And he had seen this line of poetry on the wall of this monk and asked him about it. And it turned out that this man was dying and had been dying a lot of the time Nathan knew him. And in the process of talking about this poetry, he revealed that he didn't really have a faith anymore, as in this period where he was dying, any kind of certainty about it that he'd had most of his life, and in fact that he had passed on to Nathan. But what was so beautiful about Nathan's response to that is he said, you know, I could have felt betrayed, but there was some beauty and mystery and majesty in how this person was relinquishing something in themselves but giving it to me. Mm-hmm. Again, this comes down to the mystery of us and how we are just these living, breathing contradictions and paradox, and there's the greatest paradox of all, that we're kind of made by what would break us as we go through our lives. Terrible things happen, and yet we are again and again offered this opportunity in the midst of what is most terrible and what is most unexpected to find meaning right there and create our lives. And there's nothing neat and polar about this, about wisdom, about mystery, about who we are and what we're capable of. But I think those of us who are willing to take that on as an adventure and be curious about it and allow ourselves to be accompanied and accompany others, there's a lot of joy to be had, as well as, you know, insight, edification.
That really is a story that I'm going to come back to a bunch of times and think about some more and try to figure out what it means to me. But it's really, really interesting, almost in a kind of Zen koan way.
Yeah, just to let it sit there and not be able to tie it up, right?
Right. It's just back to mystery. All right, so as we end here, we will give you one little smidgen of hope, sort of. And that is, we're talking to Krista Tippett. The book's called Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. So you end in an interesting way. You end with actually two terribly sad stories, one of them about a young woman who died in captivity with ISIS by ISIS, and another about a group of people, Muslim Americans, who died in a senseless shooting here in the United States. And that's part of your chapter called Hope. So why did you pick those things?
Well, I tell those stories because of the paradox that I learned about these people. I had the gift of knowing these people were in the world and remembering how many people at any given moment are in the world with their great goodness and beauty. I learn about them through the most terrible of headlines. You know, part of my calling, if you will, is to, like, you know, just have us open up to all the reality that is not making the headlines and take that as seriously as we take the what is tragic and corrupt. And there's plenty of that to go around, and it's real. But just kind of pointing out that, you know, even in these headlines and in these stories of the worst happening, I am reminded how, you know, abundant our world is with these quiet, you know, hidden lives of beauty and service. And what I want to do is I take that in, kind of tucked inside the stories of the terrible things that happen, is ask myself, you know, how I can better attend to these lives, these hidden lives of beauty and goodness that are still with us, and take that on as something to do in the ordinary daily spaces of my lives, as well as looking for that hidden behind the better publicized images of despair.
One great thing about interviewing a radio personality is they know how to land the plane. You know, you just landed the plane, Krista Tippett. So it's been so great talking to you. Don't be a stranger. You don't have to write a book. You can come on the show anytime you want.
I would love to. It's been a fabulous conversation. Thank you.
God is in your darkest sin, out and in and out and in. God is in. God is in. God is in, God is in.